It's Backstage Pass with Steve Ryan. And here's your host, Steve Ryan.
It's Backstage Pass with Steve Ryan, and boy, do I have a treat for you today. Today's guest is probably best known as the lead guitarist, songwriter, vocalist for the band The Looking Glass. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm so pleased to welcome into Backstage Pass, Elliot Lurie. Elliot, how are you?
Pretty good now.
Yes. We had a little bit of connection issues going, but we're there. And I'm so thankful because I wanted to talk to you so badly. I think when people think of Looking Glass, you know, obviously Brandy, You're a Fine Girl is probably the first song that comes to mind. And I feel like that song is a part of Americana. I feel like, and you tell me what you think, but it's got legs that have just stood the test of time, and generation after generation has been finding the song. How do you react to that? And do you think I'm accurate?
Well, I think it is. It has stood the test of time remarkably to me. I mean, there were bigger hits than Brandy back then that haven't sustained the way it has. So I'm very pleased with that. And I'm a little surprised, but pleased.
Why do you think that is? What is it about the song that resonates, you know, over generation to generation, over time, and just it just continues to be? I mean, you could hear it anytime. I mean, it's one of those songs when it comes on, I mean, you turn it up and you sing along with it. And you're right. I mean, there's songs from the same era that people don't listen to, or you just don't hear very often, but Brandy continues to show up, and it shows up in movies and TV all the time.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've been asked that question a lot of times, Steve. I think it's a combination of things. I think one is that it's a story song. Some people relate to the story.
Serves 100 ships a day. Lonely sailors pass the time away and talk about their homes. And there's a girl in this harbor town, and she works laying whiskey down. They say, Brandy, fetch another round. She serves them whiskey and wine. The sailors say, Brandy, you're a fine girl.
But I think one of the other interesting things about it is the production of the record. We must have recorded that thing three or four times before we got it to the point where we liked it, which is the version that you hear now. And although it sounds like a pop record from the 70s, it sounds a little different than a lot of pop records in the 70s. It has a little bit more of an unpolished sound to it in certain ways. And I think it sounds a little different than a lot of pop records from the 70s.
When you wrote that, did something in your gut say, this is a hit record? I mean, sometimes people write something and they tell me, yeah, when I wrote it, I knew it was something special. Did you feel that?
I didn't know that it was going to be a hit record because, you know, when I wrote it on an acoustic guitar. And then the band worked it up and it started to work really well. But it was always the song from our demo tapes and from our live shows that people focused on. So we started to get the feeling from the external feedback that it was a special part of our repertoire.
You said you wrote it as an acoustic on your acoustic guitar. And it just reminded me, as I was knew we were going to have this conversation, I was kind of going through your catalog and I stumbled across, I think it was in 2017, you recorded and put out an acoustic version of Brandy.
Yeah, it's a one-plugged version because I'm playing my electric jazz guitar on it, not an acoustic guitar. But yeah, that is kind of this way it sounded when I wrote it.
There's a port on a western bay, and it serves
100 ships a day, lonely sailors pass the time away. They talk about their homes, and there's a girl in this harbor town, and she works laying whiskey down. They say, "Brandy, fetch another round." She serves them whiskey and wine. Sailor said, "Brandy, you're a fine girl. What a good wife you would be. Yeah, your eyes could steal a sailor from the sea."
Well, it's a beautiful version, and I encourage people to look for it, because I had it on repeat for a little while, because you know the song so well, but it's just, there's something a little more personal about that recording that I came across that I really found appealing.
Yeah, it's the way I do it now. Sometimes when I do live shows, I do singer-songwriter style shows every once in a while, just me and a guitar. And when I do it that way, and you know, say it's more like it sounds more like the way it did when I wrote it. And you know, and then the band took the song and worked it into something for our band. And then when we went in the studio, we embellished on it and came up with the record. But the song is the same, chord changes are the same, words and melody are the same.
Yeah. And you know, it's, I think that, well, I mean, obviously it was a number one song. It's a million seller, it's a gold record. And then, you know, I think new generations have found it because of, you know, The Simpsons, and it was in Say Anything, and the movie Charlie's Angels. There was a hilarious scene where it was used in that movie. And then, you know, recently Guardians of the Galaxy. So generations continue to find it and appreciate it.
Well, Guardians of the Galaxy was a big deal because, it was a big movie. The use of the song in the movie was more than just a background use. It was a very featured use, and it's a kid's, not only a kid's movie, but it's a movie that appealed to kids. So a whole new generation found the song through that movie.
Right, right. And so I had read that that when the band was formed, you guys were, I think you were in New Jersey, and somehow Clive Davis stumbled upon you guys. Not a bad accident, maybe?
Well, he didn't exactly stumble upon us. We had a manager who got our tapes to him and set up a showcase performance for us. We played at the old Cafe Agogo in Greenwich Village. We opened for Buddy Guy, of all people, but we were put on the bill simply so that Clive could hear us play live. He'd heard our tapes and liked them. And he came down to the club and watched the set, and after the set, thought we were worth signing.
Well, and obviously he's a huge hit maker, and he knows his stuff. But tell me if this is true. He originally, well, "Brandy, You're a Fine Girl" was originally the B side to "Don't It Make You Feel Good." Correct?
Not correct. Okay. Not exactly correct. "Don't It Make You Feel Good" was the first single we released. We pressured them to release that because live we were a much more hard rocking group than Brandy would make you think. So we wanted to come with something that was more in the spirit of what the band was. But Brandy was not the B side of that. Brandy was an album track that, through a very lucky circumstance, got discovered and became the next single.
So it was, but it wasn't picked as a single until my understanding was DJs just started playing it.
A disc jockey in Washington, D.C. started playing it before it was a single. He played it off a test pressing of the album that a promotion man had given him. And he liked the track and he played it. And the request lines lit up, and the record company rushed to press singles and get them out there after that reaction in that one market.
Nice. Is it true that Barry Manilow had to change the title of his song "Mandy" because he was concerned about confusion with your song?
Well, his song that he recorded, you know, he was also with Clive, and right. The song that he recorded had been originally called "Brandy" and was a minor hit in England in a much different arrangement than what Barry Manilow did with it. But between the time that they decided to record it and the time that our record came out, they had to change it to avoid the confusion.
Gotcha. Yeah. Have you ever talked to him about that? I think it worked out well for both of you.
I haven't. I talked to Clive about it, but I haven't. I've never met Barry Manilow myself.
And then you guys followed up with Jimmy Loves Marianne, which is another song that you sang and wrote.
He don't make mistakes. What he needs, it takes. Jimmy gets all the breaks because he knows how.
Yes.
And tell me about that. How did that come about?
That was the writing of it was kind of the same way. I wrote it on my acoustic guitar, presented it to the band, and we worked up an arrangement. But that second album was probably, I got the most joy out of recording that second album. We worked with Arif Martin, the producer. Clive hooked us up with him. And, he's produced everybody from the Young Rascals to Aretha Franklin, and even at the end of his career, Norah Jones. Terrific producer, terrific guy. And we did it at the old Atlantic Studios on 60th Street and Broadway in New York. And all these characters would come walking in and out of the studio in the middle of sessions. It was really a joyous experience to make that record.
And did you guys perform on American Bandstand?
We did.
And some of the younger people may not remember Dick Clark in American Bandstand, but I do. And it was a big part of my life. I think it was a big part of a lot of people's life. And I think for you as a band at the time, was getting on American Bandstand, does that mean, okay, we've made it?
That was a big deal to be on Dick Clark. It was definitely a big deal. And, I tried to search the video from that performance, but it doesn't exist. Apparently there was a certain period of time in which they didn't keep recordings of the shows. They had them prior and they had them afterwards, but for that particular period of time, none exist. I did, however, get a hold of some still photos recently, and they're pretty cool to look back on.
Are you going to post them on your website so we can see them?
I may eventually do that. I just recently got them, so I'm still going through them, but they're pretty cool.
I'd love to see that. I mean, talk about another American icon, Dick Clark, and your answer was what I hoped it would be. I mean, Dick, American Bandstand, it was must-see TV before there was must-see TV.
I watched it way back when I was a little kid in the 50s,
Yeah. Did I hear at some point you guys were warned not to tour in Mexico because of your long hair or something like that back in the 60s?
That's another one of those stories that's almost true, but not quite. No, we weren't warned to tour, not to tour in Mexico. What happened is the drummer, Doobie, and a friend of his were trying to make just a trip to Mexico for a lark. I think we had a week-long engagement in San Diego. And Doobie decided to go down and check out Tijuana. And they wouldn't let him and his buddy cross over because of the way they look.
I got you. And so from there, the story took a life of its own.
Yeah. There's a lot of them do.
You, a lot of people know you because of Looking Glass, but you've had a whole long career in the music business. Even after, Looking Glass, you went in and... you were working in the music department as head of the music department for 20th Century Fox, and you were producing soundtracks. And tell me some of your favorite projects over there.
Well, it was interesting working over there. I mean, it's like my first real job was, as a senior executive at a multinational media corporation. So it was quite an adjustment, but it was really cool. I learned an awful lot. I got to work with filmmakers. Some big filmmakers worked on big movies, the first Home Alone, the first Die Hard. I worked with Michael Mann on Last of the Mohicans. I will say one thing. I learned that a lot of people in the film business are a lot crazier than people in the music business. There are some very strong personalities in that business, but there are also some really, really great people. Amy Heckerling I worked with a number of times, great director. So, I learned a lot.
You had mentioned Last of the Mohicans, and that is ironically the theme song is one of my favorite all-time songs. and it just fit the movie so well. And and when you guys were working on that, did you get that same impression? You know, from the music just fit the movie so well.
That's all Michael. I mean, Michael Mann, you know, he created Miami Vice, which was the most creative use of music with picture up until that time, in my opinion. So he knew what he was doing. And I had to battle him quite a bit because, you know, as a representative of the studio, I have to watch the budget. And Michael didn't keep that close an eye on the budget, but he knew what he wanted in his head. And he kept working it and spending money until he got what he wanted. And, of course, he was right.
Yeah. Yeah, because it made the movie for sure. It just they blended so well. You guys as a band got back together in 95 and did a huge show in Madison Square Garden. And tell me about that.
Well, we were asked to do the show, and since we were all still living in New York at the time, it was very convenient to do, and they gave us a great band with a horn section, and we enjoyed it. But that was kind of a one-off. Not this past Christmas, but the Christmas before, for the 50th anniversary of the song, we did another reunion. There's a show that I play on the Jersey Shore almost every Christmas. A guy named Brian Kirk. He has a great local band. I mean, they're a local band, but a terrific band. I'll give him a good plug. Brian Kirk and the Jerks in South Jersey. And they're a great band with a horn section, and I come and play with them almost every Christmas. But this time, for the 50th anniversary, I asked the two other guys to come back, and that was the first time since 1995 that we had played, the three of us together.
Wow. How did it feel?
It was great. It was really great. I see Doobie, the drummer, because he lives in New Jersey, so every time I go back east, I see him. But I hadn't seen Larry, the piano player, in really quite some time. And I hadn't played with him until since that 1995 thing that we did at the Garden. So it was really, really a joyful experience.
Any plans for you guys coming up?
As a band, I don't think so. Doobie still plays. He went on to be in a group called Stars that was like a glam metal band, and they had some success. So he still plays with a version of that every once in a while. Larry's retired. He's moved to Georgia. We're in touch a lot, you know, by email and telephone occasionally, but we don't have any plans for playing together at the moment, but you never know.
Right. Right. I like that. You leave the cup half full there.
Yeah. You never know.
I came across a song called and I think you put it out in 2017 called Better Man, and it is so smooth. It's just like butter. And tell me about that song and what it means to you.
That one was for my wife. I have a home studio. I don't use it that often. I still write all the time. But, you know, 50% of the stuff I throw out, the other 50% I may record. And then of that 50%, maybe 50% of that I throw out because I don't like the way the recordings came out. So, you know, there are a couple of things up. I'll plug it. You can look for Elliot Lurie on Spotify or iTunes and you'll find the few things that made the cut through the writing and recording process so that I was satisfied enough to put them up. And that's, you know, that's one of those, home recording.
It's a long road from where we started. There were bound to be some bumps along the way. But you were so open-hearted, and it's true in everything I do, girl, because of you, I'm a better man, I remember.
And it feels, I mean, the lyric feels very, very personal, and it feels like you kind of can get into your heart a little bit on that one.
Yeah, that one, like I say, that one was really for my wife. And the track came out kind of nice and smooth, as you say. It's pretty good for a home recording. There's another one on there that's pretty personal, too. There's one, I don't know if you've heard it, called Get There.
Yeah, it's kind of a bluesy, pop sound to it.
When I get there, I see my mama smile, take her hand, walk a while.
Get There's got some nice guitar stuff on it, I think, and it's the lyric is pretty personal on that one too.
Yeah, I enjoyed both of those. But I have to tell you, the most surprising one and the one that I looped and listened to quite a few times, and I listened to it this morning, was, and I think you just put it out last year, was a version that you did of Our Day Will Come, and it kind of has this funky disco groove to it that I just couldn't get enough of.
Yeah, here's what happened with that. I had made some recordings after I left the band. You know, I had a solo album, which did nothing, and between the solo album and leaving the group, I did a bunch of sessions with a different bunch of different players, studio musicians in New York. And one of them, a terrific keyboard player named Paul Griffin, he's worked with everybody from Steely Dan to Bob Dylan. He's gone now, he's passed. But wonderful guy, great musician. And he produced that track, and it's got like that hustle groove to it. You know, you can dance the hustle to it.
Yeah.
And it never came out. So I had a rough mix of it. And I work occasionally with this band, Yacht Rock Review. Are you familiar with them?
I am.
Yeah. So Yacht Rock Review has a great sax player. And I sent the tape down to him. And I said, would you mind putting a sax on it? And he did. And he sent it back to me. And I mixed the new saxophone into the 40-year-old track. And that's what you're hearing.
I love it. I played it over and over again. And here's why I think if people who are watching this, they need to go find that, especially if they're younger or like more contemporary stuff, because I feel like musically right now, as far as pop music goes, there's kind of a disco element coming back to it. And so I mean, that song is totally relevant right now. The sound of it.
It's interesting. I'm working with, I work a little bit with Yacht Rock Review. I don't know if I'm supposed to spill this yet, but I wrote a track that had kind of feel to it, and I shared it with Nick, who's the leader of Yacht Rock Review, and he finished the song with me, and they're going to put it on their next record, and it's kind of got that same due to hustle kind of groove to it.
Oh, that's exciting. That's exciting. Well, I can't wait to hear that. What else do you have coming up? What are you doing these days to fulfill your creative process and anything that we can look forward to?
Well, I do write a lot in the home studio, and I do shows. I do two different kinds of shows. Some of them are sort of, theme shows like Yacht Rock or 70s, where I'll play my tunes with a band. I work a lot with the band Ambrosia. Mm-hmm. And we're doing one, a cruise, actually, where Ambrosia is the backing band for me and for Peter Beckett from Player and for John Ford Coley from, England Dan and John Ford Coley. So we do a couple of those. We do tours like that. They're sometimes billed as Rock the Dock, or they have some kind of thematic name to it. And then the one I really enjoy is I do the singer-songwriting shows. I'm doing one next week. Out at a little tiny club in Delaware, intimate room holds about 100, 150 people. And I really enjoy doing those because I get to do the new material. I get to tell some stories in the show. And I really get a kick out of doing that.
Yeah. And you can kind of be up close and personal.
Yeah.
And I think people really, really like that. Where can people go to follow you or keep an eye on you and hear about stuff that's happening?
Well, you can go to the website, which I don't maintain all that well, frankly. I had a killer Facebook page, but it got hacked and deleted, so I'm trying to get that back. But
I'm hearing a lot of that lately.
Yeah, no, it happens, and it's a real struggle to retrieve it once that's gone. So I'm working on getting that back. But in the meantime, there is the website. And you can find the music on Spotify and iTunes and all of those. And there's a video channel, a YouTube video channel. If you just search Elliot Lurie, you'll find stuff both of me alone and some old videos of the band and some things done with Yacht Rock Review and live stuff. So that's kind of where you can track me.
Well, definitely do that, Elliot. I can't tell you it was a long time coming, but I sure have enjoyed this conversation. I hope you somewhere down the line, as you put out some new stuff and maybe this new music you were just talking about is ready to come out, you can come on again and we can talk about that and talk about the new stuff.
I'd enjoy that. Now that we got it working, Steve, we can get it working next time.
Absolutely, Elliot Lurie. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Okay, take care.
For questions or comments, email Steve at steveryan.songoftheday@gmail.com.